hold on to your butts, it's time for a new episode of Destroy All Culture, a sonic death ray from Dimension X that sounds exactly like a weekly podcast hosted by Adam P. Nave and Aiden Morgan. Exposure to Destroy All Culture is 100% fatal, so we put it on the internet. Now listen and die! Lethal effects may take up to 75 years. And here we are with episode 93 of Destroy All Culture with Aiden Morgan and me, Adam P. Nave.
Hello!
Hello! Gafna, pip pip.
I was going to do Miles O'Brien there, but I realized that actually just like an Irish accent right off the bat is a little bit hard for people to know what's going on.
That's
so
fair.
So I thought I'd do like just a dumb Cockney thing.
Yeah. Well, I figured there are two kind of current things we want to kind of get through kind of quickly, and then we're going to have the meat of this, which I can't wait for.
Ooh.
So, but what's a good place ended season two?
Oh, yes. Yes, it did. Good Place did indeed end with season two, and it did a thing that I did not expect, which, I mean, without being like some, ooh, big twist, like the end of season one, it managed to veer off in a direction that I did not see coming, and I thought was probably about as more understated than last season, but certainly kind of brilliant.
Yeah. I mean, and I love that it was built into the show all the way back, too, which we can get to in a second. But I have to also mention that possibly the bit that just, if ever the show wanted to make me just, like, cheer, and no pun intended, actually, it was, you know, the bartender turns around, and there's Sam fucking Malone. Like, it was just so beautiful.
And then it's like flipping the rag over his,
right, like
the towel
the
over his
the rag, which he did for so long. It's just the same set of movements.
Yeah.
And that's like it actually took me out of the show for like a quarter second because I was like it just echoed Sam Malone so hard.
Yeah, I know. It was weird. It was like he was ventriloquizing Sam Malone, which is not surprising considering he played Sam Malone.
Right.
But it was just something about it. I was like, ah.
But it was bizarre. So beautiful. Like it was earned. Yeah. It was, you know.
It was very earned, and it was sort of, yeah, it was like a demon becoming Sam Malone.
Right, which, it makes sense. But past that, the thing I love is that, you know, his line, of course, is you know, we have to figure out what do we mean to each other.
Right, what we owe to each other.
What we owe to each other, which, of course, is the book that Eleanor ripped the page out to remind her to find Chidi in season two. Well, the end of season one.
Do you know, I ran into that book years and years ago, which is funny, because I remember seeing that like in the first season. I was like, oh, that's Scanlan's work. It's, and I thought, yeah, I tried that one. It's kind of unreadable, but it's also, you know, and I have a PDF sort of sitting on my computer and have had it around for years. But it was just, it was weird, that personal connection, seeing it come back again. And I'm like, yeah, there's Scanlan again. All right.
Well, I just love that, you know, again, like it's the thing that she uses to remind herself to find Chidi the last time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then this time it's, and I mean, and very obviously keyed in because he knew it.
Yeah.
But it's the thing that sets her off to find Chidi again. But it's also, I feel like, just as a phrase, it is one of the two phrases that sums up Michael Schur's entire mindset.
Yes.
It's that and find your team. And that's pretty much everything he's ever done.
That's
right there
true.
In a bucket.
Yeah. Yeah, the team, or in some cases, like the chosen family. Like in a lot of cases with Whedon, for example, is really big on that chosen family.
Sure.
You know,
I just pin that phrase because it's the Leslie Knope thing.
Yes, exactly.
You know, but it is throughout all of his work.
Yeah, because when you said find your team, I'm like, is that? I was like, that's Parks and Rec. Where's that Brooklyn Nine-Nine? It doesn't really matter.
Right.
Yeah.
But you know, it's a great they're both great sentiments, and they're both great things to figure out, and that's where Michael Schur lives. I did see a friend on Facebook was asking, like, you know, does anyone not like The Good Place? Because usually there's always like the group of people who are just like, oh God, I hate this popular thing, and you don't see it as much with this.
Right. Well,
and I'd argue that it's just becoming really popular, so we're about to have a wave of it.
Oh, we're gonna get some backlash from dipshits.
Yeah, but I did see one person in that thread who was like, I mean, there are a few people who were like, you know, I watched it and it wasn't really my thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fair. But there's one person who was just complaining that it was too, and I quote, it was too twee and, you know, full of feelings. That's not what they want from a sitcom.
But what do they want from a
I
sitcom?
don't know. I'm like, do you just watch like Friends and Seinfeld?
Or it could be there's that whole brand of sitcom humor that actually is really about groups of people who hate and insult each other constantly.
Yes. Well,
And
Friends
then,
and Seinfeld.
yeah, and then, I mean, there's even worse examples. There's that Jim Belushi one, for
Yeah.
example.
Yeah,
I
but
mean,
it's
just.
the mean. I mean, and I do like some, and but then you can also go mean. You know, like Veep is just, yes, it's the same sort of like it's about people who don't like each other, but like to an extreme. And see, I like it when you go like to the extreme of just, and that gets into the uncomfortable humor realm, which, like, there's a fine line for I think everyone for how much of that you can take. And
I
everyone
think
has to
so.
find their own level.
But I think it's funny with the American sitcom. I mean, there are really two tendencies in American sitcoms that have been like baked into like the very DNA of the form. You've got people who absolutely sort of hate each other and it's played for laughs, in which violence is always kind of implicit, one of these days, Alice to the moon, that kind of thing. And then you've also got like characters who are genuinely, they have problems, but they're genuinely loving. I'd actually say I Love Lucy, for example. I mean, everybody kind of loves each other in I Love Lucy, and the problems are always worked out. So you've always got these two basic forces always kind of contending in sitcoms, particularly American sitcoms. And Good Place is very much about those who love each other. Set against a different sitcom in which everybody hates each other, which is also in the show. So
Yes.
there you
I
go.
mean, and again, Michael Schur has always been a huge fan of Cheers, which comes from the tradition of that specific line of like Taxi and Cheers and that sort of found family.
The oddballs who've come together, the
Right.
outcasts and oddballs.
And you
Also,
have to figure that like the whole like his open, just absolute adoration of Cheers, like many of us, like that as much as I think secretly we've all wanted to see the moment where, you know, they get him back behind a bar, but it was always like, it'd be weird, it'd be a stretch. Like, but you know, like he, 'cause I actually figured the party, like the demon party, that he might be tending bar. I was kind of like, are we gonna pull it out here? 'Cause I knew he had to do it. And I think he's been looking for the time, but he's absolutely right. Like this was the moment. This was the Sam Malone comes and fixes things, 'cause that's what Sam Malone did.
I guess, and it's funny, and I'm amazed that this never occurred to me. There was an article in Vulture on all the ways that The Good Place resembles Lost. And I saw that headline, I'm like, oh, that doesn't, that's,
Really?
I was like, that's stupid. And then I started reading and I'm like, oh, that's not stupid. I mean, Damon Lindelof did advise Schur
Yes.
on the first season, and I'm like, okay, that makes sense. But they began to like draw in the parallels with the way that Schur had sort of was thinking of the way that Lost structures things. And at the very end of this season, like they said, it's like season three, like that season moment in season three of Lost, or maybe it's the end of season two, when you think you're watching the past flashbacks and suddenly you realize that these actually aren't the past, it's the future. And your brain gets twisted around, and then you end up with somebody hopping a plane and what, going to Australia. And it's like, oh, I see. That's
That's kind
odd,
of
but
interesting,
okay.
yeah.
Yeah, it was I'd never thought of it until it was mentioned, and I was like, yeah, that's, I don't know
Well,
what to
like
do with that, but there you
someone
go.
mentioned like the color schemes for the like for the party, and then when they're all dressed up and they're in the bad place, and then they go to the judge was very Wizard of Oz, down to like Eleanor's red shoes. And it was like, okay, that's subtle as hell because it's not where the show is going, obviously. But it was just this weird kind of spiritual moment callback, I guess. I don't know.
No,
But
it's hard to imagine American fantasy without Wizard of Oz references. That's really fascinating. I guess if Eleanor had like clicked her heels at some point, that would have landed, but they probably considered that and went, no.
I mean, I like to think, and this is very much obviously wrong, but part of me would really like to think that they didn't mean it. That it was just kind of the subconscious thing.
Maybe. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
because that just makes it even better somehow.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, that would have worked. That works even better for me, frankly.
Anyway.
God, this cat smells bad. I'm breaking the continuity for a moment and telling our audience that one of my cats smells pretty bad right now, and he wants to love me.
Yeah,
cats are awful. Anyway,
little demons. But moving off of that, something I know you didn't watch, but this week's Riverdale.
Yes, let's talk
made
about
me
this
laugh
week's Riverdale.
So hard. Ooh. For all the wrong reasons, like I mean, I kind of felt bad about that, but man, they went hard in the wrong direction. No, and it was kind of gorgeous, which is the thing. Like, they overplayed some of the lighting, like, it was just hysterical. How much they were just like, look at us. This is important, this is dark, this is serious, like, it just got funny.
Damn.
And,
well,
and
mean,
again, like,
is...
I know that they didn't really intend it that way, but every time they tried to go deathly serious, because suddenly there's, like, mobsters in this episode, like, it's just, this episode just turns the dial of the ridiculousness all the way to the ending, like, just so far up, there's a moment, the whole plot of the episode makes no sense to me.
Oh, nice.
Because, like, the character's supposed to be, like, 15 or 16, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, Veronica is having her confirmation, and she explains, like, normally you have that at 13, but my parents wanted, like, the same person who, like, baptized me or something like this to, like, do the confirmation, and I guess he just wasn't available for, like, years, and then, like, her father didn't want it to happen when he was in jail, I guess, so, like, so suddenly there's just, like, a big religious ceremony just because, fuck it, we needed an excuse for one.
Oh, okay, yeah, okay.
But also because they needed the excuse of, like, you know, Veronica getting, like, really deep into her parents' business, but also still, like, loving Archie and wanting to keep him innocent. And so she's up at the altar, and the priest is like, you know, do you renounce Satan and all evil works and, you know, vow to only walk in the light? And you get the shot of her, and there's, like, all this light from the church kind of shining around her, and then it all dims down to darkness.
Oh.
And, like, she looks out and sees her parents, and it's like, oh my goodness. And then, like, she spots Archie in the crowd behind them, and there's, like, a bolt of sunlight hitting him. And he, like, smiles and nods at her, and you cut back to her, and the darkness lifts, and now it's an even brighter light. Like, it's just the funniest fucking thing.
Oh, I love this. I think, I think Catholics should stop making shows, because obviously, they're just going to keep doing this. So,
I love it. I unashamedly, like, the minute they just take all the breaks off, they're like, we're just going to go so fucking ridiculous. It is, like, a 1957 Italian, like, horror movie type of, like, we don't know what the fuck we're doing. Like, just the hell with you.
What if Douglas Sirk made a giallo movie? I think this is what we're looking at here.
Right. Yeah. But there's also, you know, the mystery of, like, who cut off the statue's head.
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
So, there is, of course, famously, one of the serpents is named Tallboy.
Oh.
Now, I initially thought it was a drinking reference.
Right.
No, it turns out, because they even mentioned, like, you know, like, because he's the tallest person there.
It's a very utilitarian nickname, then.
Right, which makes me wonder, A, who small boy is, and B, if there's someone who's just boy, because he's just kind of in the middle.
Yeah, as opposed to calling him medium boy.
Right, he's just boy. He's the line at which all other boys are judged. But so Tallboy, who's the one who's, like, hated Jughead and all this. And so, like, Jughead and Betty are like, well, we'll find the head, the statue, and that'll call off all these horrible things that are happening because they're like, oh, the serpent stole the head.
Right.
And they end up in this junkyard where the guy's like, oh, no, I found this head. Like, it was in a refrigerator, and I remember the guy who did it. And, like, you know, do you have his name? And it's like, what? The guy just said, like, he came here for some parts and he didn't buy anything. So, A, why would he have his fucking name? But they're like, can you describe him? And he's like, sure, he had one of those jackets on and points at, like, the serpent jacket. And it's like, is there anything else? Was he tall? And he goes, yes. And Jughead goes, well, it must be Tallboy. And I'm like, just really, like, he had this jacket and this one random person described him as tall. And, of course, it actually is Tallboy, which makes it even worse.
I
love that the entire, like, here's the social mystery. This mystery stranger, tall. Hey, we have a guy whose nickname is Tall. And their whole, like, he's the tallest guy there, like, seriously, by, like, an inch. Because you see him standing with other people, he's not that much tall. It's not like he's, like, 7'2".
Yeah, well, yeah, it would have been funnier. It would have been even funnier if it hadn't been, like, tall or small boy, but just boy. It's like,
right.
Was he tall? No, he was really average height. Must be boy. Curses! It says boy.
Yeah, it's just like, it was so... Just, and that's what I actually kind of love the show, and it just goes so patently ridiculous.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
this episode
I
was one for the books. Like, every single inch of this episode just kept getting sillier. Like, there's a mobster whose mob nickname is King Poutine.
Is he Canadian or some bullshit?
Yes!
I hope so.
He, like, he runs some, like, hot dog business in Canada.
Okay, I love it.
Like, it that's how he's introduced.
Hmm.
I mean, is it King Papa Poutine? Sorry,
Papa Poutine. That's still good. Still good. We don't have
like,
we don't
know,
have an actual Papa Poutine here, that, as far as I know. So, yeah.
But yeah, no, it's like, you know, Hiram's introducing these people, and he's like, you know, this guy, like, runs this brewery and all this. He's like, and this guy, like, runs this, like, the biggest hot dog chain in Canada, which is why you haven't heard of him. It's like, you know, he's known as, like, Papa Poutine, and it's like, and so, of course, you know, Pops, because they're all at Pops for whatever reason, and you know, and Pops, like, makes himself a poutine. He's like, this is garbage. And I'm like, we're having this, like, weird poutine drama in the middle of the show. What is happening?
That is so good. If he were really a big poutine mover and shaker, he'd probably be Quebecois, so he'd probably be Père Poutine, not Papa Poutine. It'd be Père Poutine. So, fuck you, Riverdale. You don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's some needlessly picky, you know, localization there.
But yeah, I just loved it. Like I said, this episode is just seriously one for the books. Cause
oh my god.
It is so nutty.
I gotta see this.
The lighting choices are amazing. Just throughout.
Oh, it sounds like it. You know, it's... That
There's
show
a scene
is...
outside Pops where they just turn on all the red neon.
Oh, nice.
And, like, that's it? That's your lighting for the shot?
And, frankly, that's one of the things I love most about Riverdale. Their lighting attitude is so go-for-broke. It's
yeah.
just... You can't... I can't get enough of it, so...
Also, there's, They make a reference to a song which was hysterical. I'm trying to remember what song it is. I'm an idiot. What the hell song is that?
I do not know.
Did
they say
there.
What would you like in your coffee? I'll have two sugars, a sugar, as in the Archie's tune.
That would be even better.
And then they just look at the camera and you know, for 10 minutes.
Yeah. I'm trying to... Oh, Bittersweet Symphony. So...
Oh. Okay.
First of all, it's a song Veronica wants at her confirmation, which...
Weird.
Right. But she references it with, do you know that song Bittersweet Symphony... from the Cruel Intentions soundtrack.
Oh, that's so good.
Which, again, like, I, you know, part of me was like, really? And I was like, no, like, for people of that age, like, that's totally what that was.
Yeah. Oh, exactly.
And even then, like, that movie might be too old for them.
That's actually what was in my mind. I was thinking, for the teens of Riverdale, that's almost a nostalgia piece at that point.
But it makes sense for Veronica to have it as a nostalgia, like, you know, because that's what she does. But just not going back far enough to the actual band just makes it funny.
Yeah. Oh, I love it.
Anyway. So, outside
you know,
of... Yeah.
So, and I was going to say that Cruel Intentions, I mean, that's a fairly... There's something kind of specific about that when you're talking about with a teen drama, a la Riverdale, to reference a movie about, like, misbehaving teens based on a French novel, it's just kind of like, okay, I see.
Right.
I see what's going
on. It's a bit meta.
A little meta. Okay, 1999, with Cruel Intentions. So
yeah,
this
so before
is...
they were born, but...
Yeah, It is a nostalgia piece for these folks. It would be in their parents' record collection. Oh my god. Okay. That's weird.
Yeah, just stop before you feel old. Speaking of old though, you spent some time watching a show this last week, I hear.
There was a time when I was an innocent person and I didn't have a really bad cold and I did not spend most of a week binge watching Deep Space Nine. But that time is over. And that is only now. Those times are only nostalgia for me. I can only be the person who's watched like a lot of Deep Space Nine in a very small amount of time.
Well, it is a very good Star Trek show.
It is. The funny thing was, I mean, everybody, like I've, you know, I enjoy the original Star Trek. It's a thing, and you know, the Next Generation had its moments. You know, there's some really good episodes of Next Gen, but I've never been what one would call a big old Star Trek fan.
Right.
Tell me that the best of both worlds is the greatest finale. And I'm sure why not. Et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, but everybody has told me for a long time that Deep Space Nine, if you're going to watch some older sort of second generation Star Trek stuff, Deep Space Nine really is the one where you get sort of into the, you know, the nitty gritty of things. It's more political. It's more mature. This is where sort of Ron Moore sort of came into his own before Battlestar Galactica.
Right.
And so on and so forth. So I started watching, and I have seen episodes of Deep Space Nine before. Like, I'd seen the pilot, like the two-part pilot before. One of the biggest... Oh, hold on, we got fighting cats. Oh, there we go. One of the biggest sort of secrets, I guess secrets or twists, I already knew it because I'd already seen the episode in which Odo discovers his long-lost people and discovers that they're the galaxy's biggest douchebags
right. All
at the same time. So I knew that already going in, and I kind of wish I hadn't because that would have been a nice little thing to find out. So I knew what it was, but for the longest time, people were like, it is the good Star Trek. And I tell you, if you're just going in blind on season one of Deep Space Nine, you would not know that this was the good Star Trek.
No,
because
like a lot of shows, especially of that time, it takes a season or two to really dig in.
It really does. And what you can truly see here, I mean, the characterizations are broad, and it was very clear that that the showrunners and that the network didn't really have confidence in the show. So they basically said, well, it'll work if we keep on throwing Next Generation characters, like just passing through the station every week. And I tell you, it did not work, but maybe they thought it worked. So there's one where like the two Klingon, the angry Klingon sisters show up. That was not great. There's a truly terrible episode where Vosh and Q show up, and Q is just like, instead of being sort of the you know, the Robin Goodfellow, the Puck, the sprite that shifts the mixoplits of Next Generation. He's basically a weird, clingy fuckboy boyfriend. And, like, you know, telling Vosh, oh, come on, stick with me.
This was the problem, right? Was that Deep Space Nine was trying to prove that it wasn't the other show.
Right.
And they tried to do that for a while in the beginning in weird contrast.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, look, we can pull these things that you're used to, but we're going to show them in a different light.
Yeah.
And I get the urge. Right. Yeah. And I mean, it really was just they were fighting an uphill battle for a while until they figured out what they really needed the show to do and had the ability to let the show be that, because the network didn't really want it either in a lot of ways. Like, so, and, no, I completely get what the problems were.
Yeah. And there's some interesting bits. Like, sometimes I really like the way they tried contrast. For example, in the pilot, there's a meeting between Sisko and Picard, and you could tell that the point of the scene was to say, hey, look, things are different in this show, but it was kind of cool, just basically where Sisko says, I remember you, you're Locutus of Borg, and fuck you, and Picard's like, well, maybe this isn't the right job for you, and he's like, still fuck you, and then that's the end of the scene, basically, and I'm like, wow, that was good, I liked it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, again, it does grow into itself more, but even in the beginning, it was all there. I don't know. I think, I don't remember if Roddenberry was still alive, but when Deep Space Nine started. I don't think so.
I don't
No,
know
he
if
had
he
to have been when it first started. Maybe.
I think, yeah. Because
it,
it still
it
feels
was started
more like
the bastard child of Star Trek for a while.
Yeah. Well, I think at the... I think they're the real turning point, as far as I can tell from what I watched, from what I was watching. Because I didn't... I watched faithfully through the first 16 episodes. And mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, I can't keep doing this.
Right.
Because I know that the show gets better as it goes along, but I just don't really... I don't quite have the patience just to, like,
well, yeah,
sit
I mean,
and watch.
When you rewatch it, I mean, for me, I relate it to shows like that, like to Parks and Rec. When
yeah.
you first start watching Parks and Rec, you just start from season two.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
And then when you go back, when you already have love for the characters, then you're like, let me look at their flawed work. Let me see the
yeah.
little side bits that I'm not going to judge them harshly for because I know that they get out of them. But until you really see how they get out of them, you can know it intellectually, but it still hurts.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So, and I also knew that, like, I could see that there was, like, the bones of something really good, like,
right.
in the show. So I basically, I started Googling. I started, you know, like, basically have people get advice on
this get good?
Something like that. And there's of course, when you Google, there are all kinds of different answers. I mean, some people will say, you know, season 4, or season 5, or season 3, or whatever. But I thought I'd start earlier, so I kind of skipped ahead to season 3. And
yeah.
that the beginning of season 3 is when Odo, you know, meets his family, basically. Meets the founders
yeah.
of the Dominion, and discovers that they're the founders of the Dominion. Which, I still love that whole idea. And, you know, all the characters are like, for two episodes, are like flailing around trying to find themselves, like find things out. Things get really weird, and then you discover it's all a simulation being run by the,
of course,
by the Dominion. Of course.
Right.
So I thought, okay, I'll just go on season 3 then. And, you know, it's still, there's still moments where it's broad. It's still moments where it's still a 90s sci-fi television show.
Of course.
Where, they got to lock down the camera for the special effects, although they do a pretty good job. And so on. But, like, you can tell, like, almost every episode after a while, there's, like a really solid good idea, or, like, a scene or a moment that you're like, holy shit. Like, there's, like, so all of a sudden this really, really good program just sort of, like, turns around and wakes up and then kind of goes to sleep
right.
again for a little bit. But I think I was sold on Deep Space Nine. It's episode 7. Of season 3. It's called Civil Defense. And the premise of the episode is incredibly simple. It's Sisko, O'Brien, and Jake are in the ore processing center, and they're basically sorting through like old files and crap left behind by the Cardassians, and they find this file, they don't know what it is, they try to delete it, and it turns out it's a security program. And all of a sudden, Gul Dukat, the former Cardassian overseer, pops up on a screen and says, "Bajoran workers, we have detected that there is an uprising in the ore processing center. We value your lives. You have 8 minutes till we kill you."
Right.
And then, so they all, they like, so basically at that point, they begin to try, like, so they're, and then it splits into two. So you get, like, those guys wandering around the ore processing center, and you get the rest of the cast, you know, Kira and the bunch, on the bridge, or in ops, I should say, trying to figure out what's going on. But everything they do to try and get around the security program only makes it worse. Like, every single move they make simply ups the level of, like, paranoia and defensiveness until finally it's like, this entire station is going to blow up in 20 minutes.
Right.
'Cause, yeah, and it's... And... But the underlying theme is, how do the oppressors, or how do the oppressed take control of the tools of their masters? And there's a very basic idea in there that you can't really ever have full control of the tools of the ones of the rulers, because it will always be set up in the ruler's favor no matter what you do. And of course the shadow side of that is, what if you use the tools of your masters, do you then become as cruel as your masters? That hasn't
right.
really become a theme as of yet, but yeah, it could. Anyway, I think that something in the Founders actually has that sort of idea. They're like, you know, we found like the solids, as they call them, you know, so chaotic and so threatening that we became worse than them, or we decided to
Exactly.
control them. Yeah. So there's like really sort of there's big ideas that they're playing with here, and it's
Right.
fun to see. Yeah,
Yeah,
and there's
they actually had the
actually
space to
yeah.
do it for once.
Yeah, exactly. And you can tell. And in season three, the other thing apparently is that I guess Enterprise ended at that point, and people and a lot of the creative team went from Deep Space Nine to Voyager, which they thought would be like the next Enterprise. So that's
Yes.
when Ronald Moore came on board, and when the cinematographer from Enterprise came on board and changed the look of the show.
You mean
And
next gen?
sorry, yeah, sorry, from Next Gen Enterprise. Sorry, from Next Gen came on board and very much changed the look of the show. They apparently the
Right.
longer lenses and like deep focus, and you can tell there are some like real sort of Citizen Kane style shots. You can tell they're enjoying this sort of the space. I don't know, and also Ira Stephen Baer began to be the showrunner at that point, I think, and began so they began to like, you know. All the plot lines that they had going and the stories they were suggesting and the character work they'd done in the first two seasons really begin to click at this point.
Right, and again, it's they weren't yet, but like when they start playing their long game, like late season four, season five, it starts to pull in everything they've been building in
Right.
season three and four, you know.
Which I have not yet gotten to. Like I was kind of hoping that Sisko would shave his head in season three, but I know that doesn't happen for a while. So.
You know, he was fighting them about that for years.
That's what I'd heard. Yeah.
Yeah,
let
no,
me
it's
shave
funny.
my
I've never
head.
watched all of it. I've never watched all of Deep Space Nine. Like I have big gaps, even in like the later years. But it is still just like it's just an honestly good show, and it gets and you say it's an honestly good show. And it's like the thing to remember is that you have to always have that caveat of, and it was still made in the time it was made.
Yeah,
as in it will still look like the show it is. There are certain conventions of TV that it still plays by. Like don't go in there expecting like oh it's this great like it's like whatever modern science fiction. No, it isn't.
It is not. No, it's got some sitcom-y moments. It looks a little out. It looks dated, obviously, and
Yeah.
there's still things that I find difficult to watch, like all the aliens, for example. You know, like the Ferengi, they keep on referring to women as females, and I just it,
Yeah,
I
that's a
it
Ferengi
really
thing to make
it,
them unsavorable.
I
And
know it, but it's still hard to listen to. You know what I mean?
Oh, it
I
is.
mean.
Oh, it totally is.
It feels like they're going to start talking about ethics and game journalism, frankly.
But that's one of the great jokes of it, right? It's like,
I know.
Is it like all the gamers, like, they talk like Ferengi.
I know. And it's funny because I've been using this episode guide devised by this one guy who's really loves Deep Space Nine. It's very sort of, very he's like, obviously he wants to play off all these sort of storylines in his essential episode guide, but I'm discovering he really likes Quark. So there's a lot of Quark-centric episodes. I'm like, okay. And, there, and
Yeah.
then, of course, and then we come to Nog.
And not an egg in sight.
And the funny thing was, as you know, by an email just the other day, I was complaining bitterly about having to see Nog on screen running around, going, "I need to see the captain," you know, or like being like this dipshit jerk, and also Jake, like fuck that. Anyway, and then I watched an episode with Nog, which actually made me really sort of feel for the character. Not only that, actually, I thought Aaron Eisenberg did a really good job. It's the episode in which he comes to Sisko and says, "I want you to be my mentor, and because I want to become a Starfleet officer." Well, these cats are just going like they're really fighting right now. I don't know why. But anyway, I wanted to hear them growl at each other.
No.
Anyway, so. Yeah, and then, of course, everybody's suspicious of Nog for, you know, like, why would he want to become a Starfleet officer? He's a Ferengi, and so on and so forth. And then finally he sort of says to Sisko, he's like, "I really want this. I don't want my father's life. My father is, at heart, not a good Ferengi. He's a really good engineer, but all he is like, assistant to, like, you know, Quark at a bar." And he said, he can't take advantage of his talents because Ferengi culture is aligned against him. He
Yeah.
said, "I'm not a good Ferengi, but I want to like, you know, live in a place where I don't have to like fight against, like, you know, my expectations." And he delivers it in this really heartfelt way, and I'm like, "Geez, dude, that's you're putting a lot of work into like this character here, and like and actually look really sort of like." Anguished and sad and hopeful and fearful, all under this like the massive prosthetics of Ferengi makeup. I'm like, okay, I'm
yeah.
I'm,
the
and
show
then I,
gets
and I
there.
haven't, yeah, and I haven't seen Nog since, so I don't know what's going on.
That was, they took him out back and killed him.
Oh, yeah,
he's,
I mean,
he's with Arch, he's with the brother in Happiness.
That's right. He's upstairs in the attic at the. At the
I completely lost. Right, I completely lost that and just started putting in Archie.
I know.
You know.
But anyway, yeah, so I'm... Right now, actually, I'm just... I just finished the episode this morning in which Miles O'Brien literally dies, and then a future version of himself from, like, 5 hours in the future replaces him.
Right.
Which I didn't expect.
Yeah, yeah. Shit happens, man.
Yeah. It's like, I'm not going to make it, but you can. It's like, oh, that's weird. But that was pretty great. As someone on the internet on an article said, there are a series of episodes on Deep Space Nine, which he's just titled, O'Brien Must Suffer. Because he's put through hell repeatedly. I don't think we're going to see his wife for any time soon either. Like, they kind of have to, like, ship Keiko off to Bajor. I'm assuming the actor didn't want to be on the show, or they didn't have any good storylines.
They didn't have enough
her.
To commit to paying enough
yeah.
for enough episodes, yeah.
Or something, yeah. So they had to move her off, and which kind of makes sense. Although they do give her a good farewell episode, or at least a good temporary farewell episode. So that's one where you really see the camera work when you've got these great shots, like these deep focus shots of her really in the foreground. And O'Brien, like, she's, like, clipping at a plant anxiously. And O'Brien sort of, like got his feet up in the background on a couch. And it's like, oh, good. Well done. I mean, it's just like
yeah.
you see all of a sudden, like, this degree of care and thought put into the mise-en-scene that you don't see before. Anyway,
no,
it's good.
Well, moving off of, but staying in science fiction, because there's something else I want to talk about. I know you've seen it, and I haven't.
Altered Cabrone?
Yes.
Yes.
And, you know, I don't remember if I've read the book, which is should say something. nothing against Richard Morgan at all. I swear to God, like, it feels like a book I've read and I don't remember it at all.
Right.
Which it could go either way, frankly. You know, I've read a lot of books and sometimes shit falls out of your head.
Yeah.
But there's a thing about the visual aesthetic of the show that I realized that just... It just hit me the other day. Because I haven't watched the show, keep in mind. I've seen, like, you know, like, trailers and all this. Is that I am tired... Like, I think I'm just tired of cyberpunk. It hasn't evolved?
No, it has not. You are absolutely correct. And I have some thoughts on this. But, yeah, continue, sir.
And it just... It's like we always talk about, like, Normancer. It's like an 18-year-old's novel. And... You know, like, Pat Cadigan, of course, who was writing Cyberpunk
right.
before Gibson, and you can go back to John Brunner, who wrote Cyberpunk before that, and there are other authors, you know, of all types who wrote that sort of thing, slowly paving the way, but Normancer cemented Cyberpunk, and I feel like it's
oh, yeah.
cemented at 18.
Do
you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
there's just the aesthetic, the whole thing was like, this is what's cool when you're 18.
Right.
And... Like, people tried to pull it forward since then, but it's never really stuck.
Yeah, I think there's a reason why, for example, whenever you look at cyberpunk, so most of the time it always feels like cyberpunk always fits into like either a thriller or a noir or like hard-boiled fiction, like detective fiction genre. Like
right.
you can't imagine like a cyberpunk sitcom.
Although there was, there's a book. God, let me see if we can find out who wrote it.
I
use
a
account,
for example.
Yeah, no, there's just one I can think of because I think I'm the only person who read the fucking book. and it's not that it's even a great book, but Let me see if I can find who wrote it, because it was years ago. Mark Fabby. I don't know if he's written anything else.
I don't... Mark Fabby.
Wrote a book called Worm.
Oh! Oh! I remember this. I haven't read it, but, it's one of these things, like, when you run a used bookstore, I mean, you just get sci-fi paperbacks up the yin-yang, so
right.
This... Yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah, no, Worm was kind of I mean, and there's also things like Snow Crash and all that, like, early Stevenson that was trying to make cyberpunk kind of funny.
Yeah.
It was allowing itself to laugh at itself.
Yeah. And you'll note that Snow Crash, like, stopped being a cyberpunk novel, like, a good halfway through it. It became a different...
Right.
It became kind of a different genre.
And I also feel like the problem was the same problem with RoboCop, is that people took it seriously.
Right, when it was already a satire. Yeah.
Right. And, yeah, I think, like, that's the problem, right? Is that, like, no one will let cyberpunk merge with... Because it has to be serious.
Right.
You know, you can't just do, like you said, like the straight-up cyberpunk sitcom, because that always plays too far. There's that... What is that Netflix show that I don't like at all that you did with the time travel thing?
Are you talking about Future Man?
Yes,
I mean,
that's it.
Hulu, but yeah. Yeah, okay.
Oh,
yeah.
Is it Hulu?
Yeah, well, whatever.
Yeah, it's one of them. Yeah, that was like the attempt at kind of a sort of comedy.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
And it's just, yeah, I mean, there are a few examples out there if you go and dig. Some early Jeff Noon, you know.
Yeah, for example.
But
oh man, I hate early Jeff Noon. Sorry, I cannot stand that like some of those ones you did. I don't know why. I would pick up, try a few pages, be like, ugh.
Oh, yuck. I get it. You know. But yeah, no, it exists. But again, it never dominated the form. It never became a thing that was allowable. So I look at things like Altered Carbon, and I'm like, part of me wants to watch it because it could be cool.
Well, it looks really cool. Like, I mean, really, if you want like sort of like just really gorgeous visuals that you've seen before,
sure.
Then by all means, watch Altered Carbon.
But yeah, I feel like just cyberpunk is always going to let me down in that it's not going to tell me anything new. It's not going to be used for anything new. It's not going to have anything new to say or a new way to show it to me.
Right.
It's like westerns. And there are some westerns I love. You know, there's some cyberpunk I love. But that on some scale, it's become locked down as a genre in that, like, no one is inventing in the space. They're just using... It's a period costume drama.
Very much. Which is
But, like,
so,
we don't think of them that way.
Yeah, because period dramas, usually westerns, we think of them as existing in a past.
Right.
But cyberpunk is a very sort of, like, stylized period drama set usually in the future.
Sure.
So, yeah.
But it has all of the same tropes of a period drama.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think, and I was, my, it was my, my brain was thinking about this. Thanks, brain. I was thinking about Altered Carbon in relation to Blade Runner 2049.
Right.
And Blade Runner 2049 does a much better job of this particular thing than Altered Carbon. But essentially, at the time, cyberpunk, when it was first being written, really was kind of, at the time, it was about the writers envisioning a particular stylized future. I mean, they were thinking forward to the future. And then at some point, cyberpunk began to be about the, like, looking back towards a particular past vision of a future that was never going to be achieved. So, for example, Blade Runner 2049 is not about the future at all. It's about that particular future that was envisioned in 1982, you know, by Scott and Fancher. It's essentially a pastiche at that point. And this is very much the same thing. But the thing was that Altered Carbon was already sort of playing, is a cyberpunk novel, I think, written in like 2002.
Right.
So it was already past its time. And it was Morgan playing with, like, Morgan doing a pastiche. So Altered Carbon is kind of a pastiche of a pastiche.
Yeah.
So it... I think it's set in San Francisco. I think that is nominally the place.
Sure.
So, but San Francisco of the future looks a whole heck of a lot like Los Angeles 2019.
Well, I
Ta-ta.
mean, and that's, a lot of I always felt like this is one of the great cheats of Cyberpunk, is that with the whole well, we have the sprawls, right? And of course that was the Gibson thing, is that it's the sprawl. So it's like any urban environment is now instantly interchangeable with any other urban environment.
Bingo, yep. Yeah. And
And
this is
there is that
it.
level of like cultural bleed and all this, and that's what they're trying originally, that's what they were trying to do, but yeah, it becomes a cheap shorthand.
Yeah.
But again, any
Exactly.
genre, I would argue that like almost any genre that doesn't try to reinvent itself and doesn't try to really find new ways to do stuff just codify it solidifies.
Yeah.
Science fiction isn't, I mean, it's a genre, but it's not, it's too big an umbrella to do that. Although
Right.
again, back in like the 50s leading into the 60s it had, because it was much smaller. There was, it was on the verge of solidifying because it was small enough that there was this risk of people weren't coming in to actually expand it, and then you had, with the new wave, you had,
Yeah,
Le
all the
Guin,
cinema
you
doctrine.
had,
Yeah.
Delaney, you had all these people who were coming out there and going, no, this can be anything. But when you get into subgenres, because they are by default much smaller, it can be easier to codify. It's like urban fantasy. When there was early urban fantasy stuff, like it was all sorts of different things, and now urban fantasy is the same goddamn thing.
Right.
It's solidified, and that's where I feel like Cyberpunk is landing, and that's sad, because it was the rebellion like genre essentially of like our youth, and so watching that solidify is just like, huh, I guess we're getting old. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, new people coming in and writing Cyberpunk now are just writing what they saw as Cyberpunk. If they want to do something new, they do something different that isn't Cyberpunk. It
Yeah.
might have some of the trappings, but it's not Cyberpunk, really. And that's good. I mean, that's a very good thing. And they will invent their own genres, which will sadly solidify over time and make them feel old, too.
Right. Yeah.
That's.
I think
Welcome to it,
Cyberpunk.
kids.
Exactly. And I think, I mean, I really enjoyed Cyberpunk back in the day. I mean, I loved all the William Gibson, those early William Gibson novels, especially that original trio. I loved Bruce Sterling, Varley, the whole bunch. But and I really kind of want to read some Varley again. I want to read Steel Beach again. Anyway, even Millennium. But at any rate, just what like watching Altered Carbon, it's like it's sort of like you I kind of wish that like sort of the level of technology and budgets that we have nowadays for this kind of entertainment had been around back then, because it feels like there'd be more imagination in some ways poured into the into the mix. Although, I mean, there's lots of interesting things to see in Altered Carbon, but often, I mean, it's just about and of course it's been infected with the Game of Thrones aesthetic and what's the constant joke the HBO CEO of tits? Yeah, obviously HBO CEO of tits has gone to work for Netflix
Well, and
because there's so
that always
much
makes me laugh because,
splash.
like, I mean, again, growing up, like when HBO and all these stations were new, it was back when you had like HBO and Cinemax, and of course Cinemax was famously known as Skinemax.
Of course.
And kind of unfairly, because HBO really had its share from the minute they started doing original programming.
Oh, yeah.
But like for some reason we all sort of ignored it
Yeah.
and just made
Or
fun
it's.
of Cinemax instead, because they were just running like shitty B movies, you know.
Yeah, and meanwhile, they're like every HBO program, like you'd have some woman just like throwing off her shirt,
Right,
like
for
for at
no
least
reason. I
one
mean, they're,
scene
yeah.
per episode, yeah. Although I gotta admit, was it Cinemax? It was the show Strike Back. I remember watching that and I was like, this is a great show where women take off their clothing periodically for no reason at all. And it was like, I mean, it was weird because the show would still work extremely well without the nudity, and it
Right.
was just sort of like, but it was like, well, this is Cinemax, so I guess we gotta have some nudity.
I think in the final form of all of this is when HBO or Showtime, which is even worse sometimes, when somebody greenlights like the big noir, like mystery show that just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, set at a nudist resort. Like, it's gonna happen eventually. They're just gonna be like, everyone's nude all the time. Fuck you.
Yep.
Now let's just get on with our show. Like, it feels like there's gonna be a defensive maneuver by some showrunner.
Yeah.
To just be like, there, are you happy now? Can we just fucking tell a story now? How about now?
Yes. That is, I really like, I love that idea. That's fantastic. I'll go for that. oh, excuse me. Yeah. The amount of like exposed flesh in Altered Carbon, it kind of makes sense. It works within the context of this future when sort of, you know, capitalism has devoured absolutely everything and turned the body into like, you know, into an interchangeable commodity. You know, bodies are sleeves. You know, minds are called the stack, etc., etc.
Yeah, all of the standard.
Yeah, and the way they've structured the show is like it's sort of it's very dense. Like the plotting is fairly dense, and there's lots of flashbacks and whatnot. Although the truth is that it's a lot of work to cover up the fact that there's not really much there, but it's still fun. You know,
sure.
That's,
I keep thinking like I might want to watch it, and then I'm just again I have that weird like I'm just tired of Cyberpunk, and I. Again, there's nothing against the show. Like, there are people who aren't, and they should enjoy the hell out of this. But
yeah.
I just can't make the energy to invest myself in, look, it's grim and dark, except for neon. Like, I get it, all right? Like, fuck you. And your shitty lighting.
Hold on one sec. I'm just going to look at something here. Yeah, just looking at the cast. The cast is fascinating because... it's one of the few. I mean, it does present one particular opportunity, in which Takashi Kovacs is the main character, and he's played by what's his face? He's played by Joel Kinnaman, but he's also played, and I can never ever remember his name, and it's gonna drive me nuts. He's also played by a well-known sort of martial arts proficient Asian actor. I'm just trying to look up his name. By the way, shame on IMDb because they have Joel Kinnaman as Takashi Kovacs, but they don't immediately have his other sleeve. You know, it's the other actor who plays him.
Yeah.
Oh, Byron Mann. That's it. Yeah. Oh, just known as OG Kovacs, and he's really good in the show. And they give him actually a fair amount of screen time. It's clear that he's not the main Takashi Kovacs, but you still see him quite a bit. And there's at least one episode that is pretty much just him in the role in like a flashback.
Right.
You know, playing himself like 250 years in the past. There's lots of great ideas that like lots of interesting possibilities that Cyberpunk presents. Altered Carbon sort of has them, but you always get a sense that like there's like the imaginative possibilities never quite fulfilled, because I mean you can do anything, like, you know,
right.
I mean it starts off with a guy being sort of like resleeved and finding out that like he's been out for 250 years. I mean that's absurd, right? And it turns out that he was part of like a revolutionary terrorist organization that was basically trying to put a stop to a world where, as they foresaw it, immortal capitalists would ruin everything. And he's woken up in a world where, lo and behold, immortal capitalists have ruined everything. And he has to sort of now live in this world and figure out how to live in this world.
Right.
Like, that would have been a wonderful idea all on its own, without the mystery. There's also a really fascinating, like, notion that doesn't get properly explored fairly early on, like he goes to a hotel, whereas it turns out no one has stayed in a hotel for 50 years because it's run by an artificial intelligence. And the verdict is that AI hotels are just creepy as shit, so nobody goes to them anymore. But you still have these like artificial intelligences that run these places. So you get scenes in which like a groups of AIs are sitting around playing like basically card games and like bitching about humans. And it's like that is interesting. Because
Well,
it's
and see, I
complete.
like that sort of thing. I
Yeah.
again, this is what I in comics I usually attribute to like either the originally it was the Kirby thing, and then it became a Grant Morrison tick of any good story, like you should have these throwaway ideas that could be their own story, and you don't care because it just does build the world depth. Like there's a story out there that you could I we could do this story instead, but it's not what we're following. When it's done well and they're just tossed off like that, I really actually do like that because it gives you a big sense of the world exists and has more story than we can tell you.
Right. Yeah, that's see
But you have
that's
to make sure that the path you're following is worth it.
Right. Yeah, no, that's it's true. There's all kinds of, I mean, they do have a lot. There's a lot of world building in Altered Carbon, and this is like just part of it. But it just feels like sometimes it feels like a missed opportunity. I think because the story is so much like noir that you're
Right.
like, okay, so you kind of know like there's some big twists that come along in the last like the last few episodes, and it's like that's not a twist. That's pretty
Well,
obvious,
I think
like,
it's
you know.
what Expanse does really well. I mean, it's not Cyberpunk,
Oh,
but
yeah.
it's that same sort of like, here's this big world full of all these opportunities, and we're gonna follow this little mystery. And it's like, oh, okay. It's like, but we're also gonna do this other stuff.
Yeah. No, The Expanse is a great
And it
example of how to
always
do
runs
that.
that risk of being too much. And so for like, as I said, I've only read the first book, but like the first book holds back from it being too much. The show in the first two seasons holds back, like it holds the line well. And I hope that that continues, but there is that risk. But yeah, I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite things in Altered Carbon, actually just following up on the AIs, is that oh, excuse me, we have this notion, of course, you know, one of the great current fears is that artificial intelligence will come along and like rule us or wipe us all out.
Right.
But in the world of Altered Carbon, they're just like, obviously they're a thing that people invented, and then they're like, I don't like it. And now they just have to like beg for scraps like everybody else at always shrinking table. And I'm like, that's like real sort of like thought put in there.
Yes.
So this is good. And the actual AI character is probably one of my favorite bits. He runs a hotel called The Raven, so he models himself after Edgar Allan Poe.
Of course.
And so he sort of plays like an American dandy-ish gentleman, and to good effect, I would say.
Nice.
Yeah, and Joel Kinnaman's good. You know, everybody in it
Yeah.
is good. Yeah, there's nobody like turns in a bad performance in the whole thing. So it is handsomely done. And really, if you want like a well-appointed cyberpunky thriller, I would recommend Altered Carbon.
Yeah, no, it's one of those, like I said, like, next time I'm in the mood for Cyberpunk again, like, I would definitely, it's just not something I really hunt anymore.
Yeah, very binge worthy. I mean, it's built to like just one episode, just like
Right.
a movie. It's a Netflix show, right? Just moves on
Yeah.
to the next. Yeah.
Well, we're coming up on the hour.
Oh, yes, we are.
So we should probably play out some music.
Oh, yeah, the music. Let's play that thing.
Woo!
Boom, ba-boom, 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 ba-boom.